Welcome to Campus Voices, a public affairs presentation from the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I'm Rick Alloway. Thank you for joining us. The topic all week on the campus of the University of Nebraska has been secrets and how they tied into the revelations contained in the Pentagon Papers. We've had a variety of guests on our campus talking about that issue, how it relates to First Amendment issues, privacy issues, the government's legitimate reasons on occasions to keep things from the public versus the public's equally legitimate reasons to know what its government is doing on its behalf. So we are speaking today with one of the prime guests on our campus, Daniel Ellsberg, who is the person who first was the person who released those documents to the news media back in 1971, faced charges about that, and has documented all of that in his book called Secrets, a memoir of the Vietnam and Pentagon Papers. And Mr. Ellsberg joins us in the studio after an exhaustive couple of days here. I'm thrilled you're able to be with us today, and we appreciate some more of your time this afternoon.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
This has been, I know you have been through the history of what you did, and you've documented it in great detail in your book over and over and over again. We'll probably get to a little of that, but I'd like to talk about how that relates back to where we are today, because you have spent all the years since this happened trying to continue to send the same message that it's an ever-present and ever-vigilant populace that needs to keep this from happening again. And yet, as you've mentioned a couple of times on our campus, it seems that in many cases we're right back where you started in the mid-60s. What do you consider to be the enduring legacy of all the work you did with the Pentagon Papers and everything that's happened since?
Well, of course, you're asking me what's the enduring legacy of an episode that was involved, was part of a movement that ended a war. And here again, we are involved in a war that was entered into with just as much deception, just as unconstitutionally as Vietnam. In fact, more obviously in violation of international law than Vietnam was. Iraq, I would say, was as clear a case of aggression as was Saddam's invasion of Kuwait or Soviet Union into Afghanistan, or to go back further, the German invasion of Poland, or Japanese into China. Clear-cut aggression. And that was not so true of Vietnam. As a matter of fact, Vietnam had the appearance, an effective cover story that fooled most people then and now, that we were supporting a sovereign government against an invasion from the north and so forth. That was extremely misleading, and I myself didn't see through that till I'd read the top secret volumes of the Pentagon Papers, the inside story, and realized that it was a government we had essentially created and run from the beginning, and that we were no more legitimately there than were the French. But under the UN Charter, even the French had more legitimacy than, let's say, our occupation of Iraq, because the UN Charter chose to recognize colonial possession for a while, and the colonies didn't become independent for some time later. So here we have a situation now where the public proved as vulnerable to being lied into a war as they ever were 40 years ago, and that's disheartening. Although not as disheartening as what we're facing right now, where I sense, more than sense, that we are in the process of being lied into a war against Iran just 5 years after we went into Iraq. That is dismaying. I can understand people forgetting, quote, lessons of Vietnam after 35 years. But we've now had enough information about how much lying was done to get us into Iraq and what the motives really were and weren't, that you would think that the public would be more resistant to going through that process again. And yet, I don't sense that we are. That's a bad change, and I don't fully understand it. It's certainly not a happy one.
Well, you just partially answer my next question by saying you're not sure what causes this, because that was my next question: is why are we not learning the lessons that have been played out three or four times since
the 1960s? History doesn't have clear-cut lessons, really. It tells a story, and you have the choice of interpreting that story and drawing it. Say what it has to say for you in the present. And people can always say, that was then. The conditions now are entirely different. I even found, I should say, that when I put out the Pentagon Papers in 71 under Nixon, it was the story of four previous presidents, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. And I knew that the fifth president, the present president, was being just as deceptive as his predecessors in the same way, though I couldn't prove it. I didn't have the documents. The Pentagon Papers ended in 1968, before Nixon came in. I knew from oral testimony of people who were working for Nixon that he was following in their footsteps, but I couldn't prove it. And I found that the documents themselves didn't have the effect I hoped they would. People would draw the dots, as they say now, would extrapolate and say, maybe we can't trust him more than the previous ones. Didn't work that way. In answer to your question, I think one answer right now is that people's tendency to trust the present incumbent, that he's doing differently. This is a little odd to say because it's the same president as in Iraq. So it really involves trusting him to do differently from what he did in Iraq. I don't fully understand gullibility to that extent, but it seems to be an extremely strong tendency to want to feel that the president that we've elected, and he was elected after he'd gone into Iraq, that the people either we voted for or that we failed to be effective in opposing has our best interests in heart as we see them, that he's doing the best that can be done for us, what we would do if we had his information. And, you know, he's not perfect, but do better than people who don't have as much information. That's actually not true. The power of the office, the secrecy surrounding it, is a great temptation to follow impulses and inspirations that may be crazy. Iraq was crazy to go into, as was seen by practically everybody in the government except Bush and Cheney and a few people who worked for him, who have mostly since left. But Bush and Cheney are still there. The idea of attacking Iran is just as crazy as Iraq. And yet, I'm afraid what the Pentagon Papers show is a president who has a crazy idea like that, for whatever reason, can get it done. The truth is that the president I worked for, Lyndon Johnson, and I later worked for Nixon shortly, and I'd worked for Kennedy a little before that, in the case of the escalation in early 1965, that was as, I keep using the word crazy, but I want to distinguish it from questionable or arguable or controversial. It was insane. You couldn't make any sense out of it. To this day, and 40 years have passed, to this day, I, and I think anybody who worked with me, cannot say confidently how Johnson could have ignored the inside advice he had to stay out of that catastrophe. What went on there? I still really don't know. The Pentagon Papers don't answer it. But that pattern is still going on. So the intellectual legacy, the Pentagon Papers deserve reading today. People who read that book, which came out in 2002 as we were approaching the war in Iraq, all said to me, I have the sense that I'm reading current history. This seems very current. That's true. The resolution that delegated to the president unconstitutionally, the power that the Constitution gives only to Congress, the power of declaring war, that delegated to the president the decision when and whether to go to war, was exactly the same as the Tonkin Gulf resolution, except for a change in the words. I suspect they pulled that right out of their drawer and simply changed the place names. That's going to happen again on Iran to a considerable extent. It's already happened. There have been resolutions now that virtually give the president a green light. Hillary Clinton signed that resolution, and I noticed just last week the other Democratic candidates fell on her for that. Well, I was glad to see them criticizing it. I'm not sure they would be criticizing it if they didn't need to distinguish themselves from Hillary Clinton at this point. Maybe they would be taking her position. But at any rate, I'm glad to see them doing that. But will that lead to Congress putting any obstacle into the way of a war with Iran? I don't foresee that. The war is not certain. The Joint Chiefs are against it, as far as we know. The Defense Secretary is against it. The Secretary of State is against it. That should be conclusive, one might think, because they're right. They're obviously right. The reactions of Iran would be disastrous to an attack on Iran, against our troops in Iraq, against the price of oil, the shipping in the Persian Gulf, terrorism in this country, the hatred of the Muslim world. All that should rule it out, but it doesn't. With Bush and Cheney determined to do that, to have an air attack before the war, before their term is up, I have to say that the odds favor, it's not certain, but it's more likely than not that we're heading into a catastrophic war. If that happens, the congressional record will show no obstacle put up by Congress to the approach of that war, which is outrageous. It's something I'm trying to understand right now. If you can tell me more about it, I'd be happy to hear it.
I wish I could. One of the themes that runs through your book is the disappointment, dismay, disbelief you encountered time and time again when you attempted to give these documents to people, and they were either refused to take them, waiting until they could gain them through some official release from the government or for whatever other reason, senators, other people as well.
That's happening now.
And yet I've heard you say last night that you feel one of the concerns is that someone in the government who may have information like that now needs to step forward now and not wait. What gives you any confidence that there would be any more receptive audience to that sort of document being released now than what you encountered 40 years ago?
Well, it's hard to say what I have confidence about. I don't have a lot
Fair
of
enough.
Confidence about practically anything at this point. People ask me if the Pentagon Papers would get published now. I do think they would be. That's my first answer to that. I think if you present actual documents, you can get them published. Of course, there is the internet now. In a certain sense, you don't have to have them published by a paper. But it is better to have the Times publish them in full or the Washington Post. I do think you could. Now, in the case of the Times, they did have not documents, but they had the information that the president, as of December, or rather October 2004, before the election, had for 3 years been carrying out a totally illegal and unconstitutional process of spying on Americans through the National Security Agency. They were asked by the government not to print that, so they didn't. A year went by, and they finally did present it, and very creditably, against the objections of the White House. A year late, because if it had been a year earlier, it could well have swung that close election. And I think they have a lot of responsibility to bear for that. But anyway, they put it out, and the process is still going on. So people do challenge me, and it's a very fair challenge. Why do you think that any new revelations or leaks would have any effect? Look what we've learned about Abu Ghraib, about the National Security Agency, about renditions, about secret prisons. We've learned all these things, and all of it's still going on. It hasn't had any effect. All I can say to that is that, first, they've come out in kind of fragmentary form on the one hand, but above all, by anonymous leaks. They haven't been the Pentagon Papers. Now, the Pentagon Papers themselves were only history. They came out after the events and with a new president, and I would have to say did not have an effect directly on his policy. That's what I've learned. It takes current information, but it takes current documents. So I still have not confidence, but a hope, a strong hope, that if somebody were willing to put out not just a page or two, but a small fraction of what they had in their top secret safes in their office, 1,000 pages, 2,500, that show context and show the policy and make it clear, and then be willing to testify about that in front of Congress. Now, again, a year ago, that would have seemed hopeless with a Republican Congress. They simply wouldn't be called to testify against their own party's president. I would have hoped that it would make more difference than it has to have Democratic chairmen of these committees. But we still haven't heard hearings on surveillance or National Security Agency, that's the same, or signing statements, rendition, that is kidnapping. I just saw the movie Rendition the other day, very, very powerful. It's happening. And it was just last week that Condoleezza Rice admitted that, quote, a mistake had been made in sending an innocent man to Syria to be tortured for a year, but unwilling to apologize or provide any money, as Canada had. And of course, no assurance that that isn't still happening. I still note that Congress has not been challenged yet to hold hearings with somebody who has revealed documents, who is available to be cross-examined, who can testify to the meaning and the authenticity, and they can then call the people who wrote those documents and ask them to explain them and how they explain so clearly violating the law. Now, would they get them under this president? That's something new. The president's simple refusal to provide under subpoena, under subpoena these people for questioning. Well, as I say that, I have to take it back. Nixon did, in fact, refuse at first to provide John Dean. And that's what ignited the Watergate fire to a considerable extent. They got mad at the fact they couldn't get Dean. Eventually, they did get him. And, of course, he broke it open. He didn't have documents, but he had what appeared to be an encyclopedic memory. It wasn't in retrospect. Once the documents came out, his memory wasn't as perfect as it sounded at the time. But it was very impressive. Even so, without the tapes corroborating his memory, Nixon would have stayed in office, and the war would have gone on for another year. So you had the president's counsel, as good testimonies you could possibly have, very confident, very, very factual. Even so, the White House just said, wrong, he's lying, didn't happen. Haldeman said, he's lying, and of course, in the end, Haldeman went to prison for perjury for having said that. So the tapes were crucial. And in this case, I'd be glad if we had tapes, but documents would do the job. We still haven't seen them, and I'm still asking people to bite the bullet, as it were, lose their clearance, give up their clearance, give up their hope of working for any president. That's a very big hurdle to cross. Very few people ever accept that. And possibly be prosecuted under this administration and maybe go to jail, which would be terrible for them and their families, but actually not worse than it is for the families of the millions of Iraqis. A million, I don't want to exaggerate. 1.2 million millions who've lost their family members, or the 3,000 families who've lost members in Iraq. When people are risking their lives and bodies every day as they see it for their country and doing their duty, I don't understand why it's not possible for an American official to risk his or her career in order to tell the truth and to obey the oath that they took to uphold the Constitution.
Well, since we're based in a journalism college, I'm interested in your thoughts, too, about what role the media play in this information getting out, and how you feel the media what kind of a job have they done covering and asking appropriate questions and holding people accountable?
On questions, I would have to say not very well. I think of lots of questions the president should be asked by someone who is willing for that to be their last White House press conference. But it's hard to find somebody like that who gets in the first place, who's willing just to go once by asking the president a question that he really doesn't want to hear. Not good at that. Not good at covering what's going on in Washington generally. The internet is available now, and one does find a lot on the internet that was not available before. Second, there really are important revelations, like the secret CIA prisons that the Washington Post exposed, which still exist, or the NSA surveillance that the New York Times belatedly put out. I think there were two Pulitzer Prizes for those. Very worthy, so that was very good. But I hearken back to what people used to ask me in Vietnam as to what I thought the job of the media, how well they were doing their job. And I said, well, there are two ways to answer that. One is terribly, but better than anyone else. And the other is better than anyone else, but terribly. And I think that's still true. Compared to the job that Congress does, that the officials do in upholding their oath, protecting us, upholding their oath to observe the Constitution, bad. They're violating that oath all the time. How about the churches who might be more concerned about the torture issue than they are, compared, let's say, to abortion or gay rights, gay marriage? I don't think that gay marriage is as important to this country as an issue or to the churches, to their moral codes, than the question of wholesale torture and atrocity being carried out by this country in violation, a clear-cut violation of laws and moral codes, and so forth. It seems to me that the press does do an indispensable job of informing us, but do we know as much as we need to know or as they could tell us? Certainly not. If they were, I would think it impossible that a president who endangered this country mortally, let's hope not mortally, seriously, by attacking Iraq, making our al-Qaeda enemies, the terrorist enemies, invulnerable. Not the individuals that we kill, but in terms of recruitment, in terms of resuscitation. Al-Qaeda will never be strongly reduced as a threat to us while we occupy Iraq, and that will be a long time. Now, the president who did that in the name of protecting us did not deserve to be reelected. In my opinion, and I speak as a, I'm almost hesitant to say this, but as a long-term Democrat, I hesitate because I'm not very proud of the Democratic Party at this point. But to say that, I have my differences over policy, of various kinds with various people. I have to say that it was discreditable to vote for George W. Bush in 2004 after we'd seen 4 years of his operation. And yet the press allowed people to believe that he was a man who would keep us safe. There hadn't been another 9/11, that was true. But Al-Qaeda, by all intelligence circumstances, was much stronger than it had been in, say, 2002. I have to blame Kerry, the Democratic candidate. He didn't make that an issue, in part because it wasn't an issue for the country. He feared that it would be too easy to be slandered, as he was on the Swift Boat issue, if he appeared weak on terrorism. And I have to say, a lot of people died in Vietnam because Democrats were afraid of being called names, being called weak on communism, being called unsupportive of the president, not supporting the troops. They knew the opposite, but they were afraid of those names. And the same is true right now. Democrats afraid of being called weak on terrorism, afraid of being called traitors slanderously, or unpatriotic, or not supporting the troops. To avoid that, they pay the money to send more troops to kill and be killed in Iraq. And that's shameful.
The country seems to swing, at least politically, on such a razor thin edge, conservative to Democrat in terms of who, or liberal in terms of who controls Congress, that does that, is that vastly different than, we seem so polarized, red state, blue state. It seems that's far more dramatic than I remember it being in the 60s and 70s, though there were certainly anti-war protesters, but it seemed like Congress at least had a little more ability to get things done because we do seem gridlocked
right
now.
Yes and no. On the question of foreign policy, it may seem from what I've said so far that I'm only critical of Republicans. That's certainly not true. We have a Republican president. But the Democratic president that I served faced a Congress that by 64 was two-thirds a Democratic majority, a veto-proof majority. And to their credit, I will say, there was a great deal of opposition to the war among Democratic leaders. We don't, unfortunately, see that among Republicans now. Why they are moving in lockstep so clearly with their leaders and their president is, I don't know all the answers. There's some changes in the way things are. So a Chuck Hagel stands out as somebody who's willing to take a stand as a senator and as a citizen and as a Vietnam veteran, which, of course, distinguishes him from all of the incumbents in the administration. I admire him greatly, and I'm sorry to see him leaving the Senate. I wish I heard his voice as a presidential candidate right now. But so we had 67 senators in the Senate. They weren't willing to turn off the money for the war at any point until Nixon had been led to take all the troops out. Then they cut off the money for the bombing, which was very inconsequential because he intended to bring back the bombing. They didn't even know that. I knew that, but they didn't know that. That stopped him from bombing. That was very important. But prior to that, they were not able to bring themselves to cut off the money any more than the thin majority now, and they had a veto-proof majority then. So that's not a change, and the party doesn't make a change. I must say that for all my disillusionment about my Democrats party, I hoped that having Democratic chairman of investigative committees would make more difference than it has over the last 6 months. And I would have to say it's made no difference that I can perceive. I mentioned earlier there have been no hearings on these various subjects. We heard from Jay Rockefeller of the Intelligence Committee when he was in the minority. As soon as I'm in the majority, if I'm in the majority, we will have hearings on on the misuse of intelligence that got us into the war. We have not had such hearings. John Conyers talked about impeachment when he was in the minority on the Judiciary Committee. But he was told by his House leader, impeachment is off the table. Negotiation with Iran is off the table. Threats of nuclear weapons against Iran are on the table, each of our candidates assure us, outrageously. Not one candidate being willing to say nuclear war to prevent nuclear weapons, nuclear war against a country that hasn't attacked us, that's not on the table. That is not a legitimate option for the United States. On the contrary, they say the opposite. But impeachment is off the table. Looking into the past is off the table. Even though it's not past, it's still going on, and it's about to be repeated. And yet, no investigations. So I was very much of an adversary of the Nader campaign, which I felt was likely to hand the election again. This was back in 2004, but again in 2004, to George Bush, which I thought was very irresponsible. But his claim that there was no difference between the parties is looking less irresponsible than it did to me then. In the field of foreign policy, it's hard to point. I'm sure there is a difference in domestic policy, and that's a reason for me to vote Democratic again. But it will not be with the expectation that Democrats would get us out of Iraq.
Well, you state here at the end of your book, and it's almost chilling to read now because you're quoting from one of the last of the White House tapes where the president says, "What in the name of God have we come to?" And you say, "What we come back to is a democratic republic, not an elected monarchy, a government under law with Congress, the courts, and the press functioning to curtail executive abuses as our Constitution envisioned. Moreover, for the first time in this or any other country, the legislature was casting its whole vote against an ongoing presidential war. It was reclaiming through its control of the purse, which you just mentioned, the war power it had fecklessly delegated 9 years earlier. Congress was stopping the bombing, and the war was going to end." And you were quoted in a speech in a couple of months ago saying you had awoken from a sleep to find out that a coup had taken place, and they were looking at an executive presidency, you were saying you think is in the works.
I hadn't an imperial presidency. I hadn't looked back at that. It just reminded me, and it's very painful to hear that in a way, because in every respect what I said was happening in 1973 and 75 is reversed now. There is no prospect of Congress cutting off the funds for this war. Now I would say in the indefinite future, but it's worse than that. Nixon, I said we restored a constitutional government then, against secret efforts to escape from those constraints by Nixon. And though we didn't even know it at the time, it came out generally later, Johnson had been doing the same crimes and unconstitutional actions as Nixon and as Bush is doing now. But we didn't know it. Hence, he wasn't subject to impeachment. And I must say, I'm not confident the Democrats would have impeached their own president anyway if they'd had him. But in any case, Nixon, when his crimes were revealed, some against me and against the Constitution, he did face impeachment. A difference now is that these same actions by the president have become available, and impeachment is off the table. But worse than that, there is no Watergate hearings going on. There are no investigative hearings of various kinds. And worse still, I don't think these previous presidents who acted secretly like kings had in mind to transform our form of government permanently in that fashion. Kennedy to some extent, but Johnson very much, and even Nixon, I think, mainly thought of themselves responding to an ongoing crisis. What books like Takeover by Charlie Savage and The End of America by Naomi Wolf, It Can Happen Here by Joe Kanazin, which I've just been reading, make it very clear that it was in that very period that I was writing about that Richard Cheney was forming an opinion that has never left him. Nixon was right. He should not have been impeached. He was doing what were his rightful powers. So were Johnson. An imperial presidency is exactly what we need. The Constitution interpreted as traditionally to have separate branches of government with checks and balances was wrong or outmoded. And what we need is a president who decides for himself what the country needs without any check. In other words, the king. That's what we have right now, and Congress is giving no opposition. And I am afraid, so in a sense, as I said, there has been a coup. Cheney has gotten his way, essentially. The people who criticized him and opposed him in the government, to their credit, like James Comey of the Jack Goldsmith, who's back at Harvard, have left and given the way. The torture is all still going on. And I'm afraid that one more 9/11 or war with Iran will see what amounts to a second coup that completes the first. And then we will be what we are not today, a police state. If this were a police state, I wouldn't be here with you today. After the next 9/11, people like me will not be here with you.
Well, we're glad you have been here with us today. We appreciate your time. It's been a delight to meet you, and we appreciate your time on our campus. You're welcome back anytime. We hope to see you again soon.
I hope that the coup doesn't happen.
Our guest has been Daniel Ellsberg, activist, author, self-avowed whistleblower, and we're glad he's been with us today, as we're glad you've taken time to join us on Campus Voices, a public affairs presentation of the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I'm Rick Alloway. Thank you for your time.